psychology. In introducing our speaker, I can do no better than to employ the language of those who arranged to bring him to UBC as a Cecil and Ida Green visiting professor. One of his proposers wrote as follows: Dr. Wasserberg is a distinguished, witty, and eloquent earth scientist of international reputation. He has received many honors for his accomplishments in the applications of mathematics, physics, and chemistry to problems of the earth and the solar system. He has made great advances in the measurement of absolute geologic time from radioactive elements. He has modified the time scale of the solar system. He has done work in the origin of the elements and the variations of isotopic abundances, on the age and history of the moon and the origin of the solar system. This is one man I am speaking of, ladies and gentlemen. He is a distinguished teacher and professor and has been chairman of the Committee for Planetary and Lunar Exploration Study and a member of the Space Science Board of the National Academy of Sciences in the USA. The letter then goes on, recommending that he be brought here to list innumerable honors he has deservedly won. And another sponsor says, and this appeals to me, Professor Wasserberg's mathematical elegance and the intensity with which he attacks a geochemical problem or foolish geochemists is complemented by a wry sense of humor. In the quiet corners of some of his papers lurk hilarious bits of wit. Also notable is his invention of tongue-in-cheek acronyms that have become part of a respectable scientific vocabulary. He obviously can take a lighter view of the universal questions about which he is seriously concerned. Tonight, he will take, I presume, both a light view and a serious view of the subject, stars, gas, dust, and planets. Dr. Wasserberg.
My trifocals and your bifocals don't quite match, I can see that. Well, first I'd like to say that I came here for a variety of reasons. One is some old friends that I have at UBC. I don't mean they're old, but I've known them for 30 years. And the other is that I had a wonderful promissory note that I would have the privilege of watching the Rites of Spring in Vancouver. And my wife and I went for a walk this afternoon, and through the rain we saw such a wonderful display of flowers and plants that we can't grow at home because we don't have water. I'm surprised you can grow them with sunshine, without sunshine. I'd like to thank you for those of you not in bathing suits who came here tonight to hear my talk. I am somewhat troubled. I'm probably going to say too much too fast. And I was warned by an omnipresent power that was sitting behind me in the seat with her foot on my back, as a matter of fact, that this was a very vigorous audience that would question everything I said. And I'm used to that. And as long as you don't expect answers, that's just all right. Now, we have a couple serious things to say, and that is I have been pronounced to be a witty speaker. Now, that's a pretty grave threat to anybody. It means you're supposed to perform, and when I read that in the announcement, I was both flattered and pained. It reminded me of the story of Mark Twain when he was invited to speak, and a local lawyer got up and stood around like this and talked about Mark Twain's accomplishments, and then he said, Mark Twain is most unique amongst public speakers who are humorous. He is actually funny. Mark thanked him for the compliment and said that he thought that he was not truly unique. The most unique thing was the person who introduced him was a local lawyer who had his hands in his own pockets. So there it is. I'll try my best. Now, I have to try to say what I'm going to do. It's going to be a difficult thing, and I'm going to try to tie too many things together for you. and it will be a sort of a kaleidoscopic view of a very complicated bunch of fields. And I hope that while you may not follow the particular details, and heavens knows you probably won't believe those which you do follow, which would be a good sign, that will be a panoramic view of the field, which might be sometimes out of focus, but hopefully give you some idea of the things that are exciting that are happening now. That's a slide that says it's in focus. This is like running a mass spectrometer. Jesus Christ. Here it is. That's Ford. There we go. Now, that's the real subject of the discussion is gas, rocks, and water. And what persists in the objects, the material objects, some of which we rest on, that give us some insight and understanding into the past. And we will try to go pretty far back in the past of the solar system on which we are resting. And part of the problem with the past that we have to look at is a problem of clocks. And the clocks are not always going to be in the best shape. And it is our problem to ascertain how to read the clocks and what physical processes are responsible for the times which they read. And sometimes there may be some deformed clocks and some skinned and scalped scientists with a mustache who are involved in this as well. And it is this general issue of processes and time that I really want to talk about. And the processes and time, if I can figure out, did I push the wrong button? Oh, there it is. Oh, I'm sorry, I goofed, yeah. Processes and time is the old Dolly picture, the persistence of memory. And the persistence of memory that we want to really ultimately talk about is the persistence of the memory of the very earliest formation of the solar system, which remains in physical objects, sometimes of very small size, and which allow us to make rather presumptuous and enormous claims about things that happened a long time ago, some of which are very exciting, and many of which just happened very recently. And the real idea that I want to have as a theme is the persistence of memory of the early history of the solar system about 4,500 million years ago, 4.5 eons ago, and the connection between stars and us, which some of us who've been in the business a long time never thought we'd ever live to see. And with this Dali-esque sort of introduction, let me try to expose the basic problem. We are sitting right there, it's supposed to be the Earth. It's a cartoonist depiction of the solar system, and it's done because I like cartoons, and also nobody's gotten to take an outside picture yet. Now, the debris of highly segregated chemical materials, from a big mass of gas to chunks of rock and other gassy objects, some frosty ones that come in on occasion like the comets, really have their origin in material which pre-existed the solar system in the interstellar medium and in stars. So the material that's around in our local debris heap on which we ride right here is material that came from interstellar gas, dust, which is about 10% by weight of the matter in the interstellar medium, and chunks of stars from different layers in stars. And it is this monumental precursor that we want to have some connection with. And in all cultures, there are mythologies of creation. And in all wars, there are mythologies about the victors and the vanquished. In every case, in anybody writing a mythology, every effort is made to have your precursors as being extraordinary persons and giants in some fashion. And anyone that you vanquished, of course, must have been incredibly strong. And we will try to pursue the same point of view to improve our own image. And what I want to do is to actually try to show you that from some junk that falls in over here, we can in fact say some rather remarkable things about the detailed history that that precedes us. Now, this gentleman lived several hundred years ago. His name is Nostradamus, and written in French, which I'm sure you can read, but I can't read from here, says, I proclaim the truth simply and without ceremony, and my genuine omen does not deceive me. My problem is to deceive you. The time scale which I'm going to make the pronouncement about, or I should say, I speak as a speaker, but really for the scientific field as a whole of many scholars who are involved in this, is that before the debris heap in the solar system was formed, which we showed you over there, we now make the following modest statement. Somewhere between 300,000 and 1 million years before the solar system was formed, a star exploded, or a star was very violent and active, and contributed material, a substantial amount indeed, to the stuff that went to make up the solar system, and that dust, rain, and hail, some of which may have been, in fact, interstellar dust grains floating around between stars, some rain of particles, raindrops, and hail stones fell out of a hot gas cloud in this time scale of a few hundred thousand years. This was then accumulated in 10 million years to make small planets, which got very hot and melted in a few hundred thousand years. And it was full of radioactive nuclei like aluminum-26, palladium-107, and possibly calcium-41. And that 100 million years later, when all of these radioactive nuclei were dead, the big chunks of planetary bodies that we saw in the other slide were made, and 100 million years later, which these were absent, and that these large planets then had to melt by accretion. Now, this modest pronouncement about the time scale here should be kept in some sort of perspective. When I tell you that we're talking about 100,000 years resolution back 4,500 million years ago, that's 4.5 eons ago, what I'm talking about is ability to resolve events corresponding to one day of time at the birth or conception, that's the issue really being discussed now, of a 45-year-old person. And that's not too bad. Most of us never thought we would ever be able to seriously present objective evidence on such a matter, and it is particularly toward this end that I will speak today. Now, the objects for which we've gotten views of are shown here, and these are the more of the terrestrial planets with the unfortunate missing of Titan of real photographs taken from spacecraft. And I have, that is a rather recent picture, and here is an old one made up in the 60s when I even liked cartoons then. In fact, I grew up reading comic books. When our whole picture of the solar system was made from our knowledge of the Earth, stony meteorites and iron meteorites, which thank heaven fell in on us, and we had never been to the moon and certainly never seen the spectacular views of other planets. And it's this view of these objects and the interrelationships which will permit us to construct almost everything that we want to say. But I first want to give some perspective about the Earth and the Moon before I go on and go back too far back, because the question is, where do you look for these fragments and pieces of evidence of the birth process of the solar system? And the time scale for formation of the crust of the Earth is indicated schematically here, but not too schematically. This is the rate at which continental crust is made backward in time. Here is now. And the oldest known rock on the Earth is about 3.8 eons ago. And we have no direct information about the interval between the time the Earth formed and the last and oldest rocks which have so far been found. Now, if we look at the Earth, which is somewhat out of focus over here on the audience's right, there are two blocks of matter, the continents, which are relatively old, and the oceans, which are full of volcanic rocks with a typical age of only 50 million years, and so they would plot somewhere backward here in time. So if we look on the Earth, the chance of looking at a timeline which is narrower than the pen line drawn to make this cartoon for the time of formation of the Earth is totally impossible from a terrestrial point of view, because the oldest rocks we have, which are on the continents, are in fact relatively young. It's truncating here about 3.8 eons ago. Now, in contrast, the situation on the moon is somewhat different. The Earth has a lot of water. There's 1 kilogram per square centimeter of air, and the water's quite a vigorous erosive force. And the moon, the major history is a micrometeorite bombardment, galactic cosmic rays, nuclear interactions, and the solar flare blowing in particles and small particles chipping up the rocks that are knocked out by larger debris impacts. And here's one of our students doing his field work. Actually, he didn't get his thesis for that work. It wasn't complete enough. And this is a small impact on the moon. Now, this debris heap allows us to go a little bit further backward in time, and also shows us something very different about a planet and its history. And the impact processes produce rocks such as these, which is 14321, and those of us who have made love to this rock have very great fondness for it. It's intimate sutures and characteristics are best seen by the angular chunks of material. It is an aggregate of junk brought together by impacts. And so when it comes to the persistence of memory for rocks of this sort, each little subpart, as indicated in this microscopic view, this is simply an aggregate of broken up little rocks, which is like most meteorites. So that in our ability to read clocks and to say anything about time, we must be able to say something about those clusters of material which have some coherence, so that clock reading tells us something that's useful. And that's a breccia. The other rocks, and those are made by the big impact basins, which we see, and the small ones. The other rocks are basalt, such as these, which is from Apollo 15, and where the crystals in such a rock are intimately intergrown and are the result of cooling of molten silicate mass to grow these crystals. And because all these crystals are interrelated toward by the birth process of having crystallized from some melt, their interrelationships permit with great clarity a measurement of age. Now, I want to say something, since we are going to talk about things which are far messier than this, and in the persistence of a much more ancient memory, as to what it means to measure the time of an event. And what I will say will not be too technical, but all of us can understand the simplest principles, which is all that we do. If someone wishes to say how long this lecture has lasted, or that is to say, they will have had to have 2 clocks in their pocket, which were running synchronously. And when they entered the room, their instructions would be to smash 1 clock, to wait until the end of the lecture, smash the other clock, read them both, and subtract the 2 numbers. And everything I will tell you will just involve that calculation. The technical tricks necessary to do this are somewhat larger. The other thing is, how credible should you believe this wonderful subtraction, since I'm going to tell you a bit of a myth, if not a fairy story? And that is best exposited by saying, imagine I have a whole cluster of clocks, each of which runs, as measured today, at a different rate. Will the differences in time still be the same for each pair? In which case, then you have great reason to believe the number which is calculated by this difference. And this is displayed in the so-called evolution diagram for the case of strontium 87, which is produced by rubidium 87 decay, in which the ratio of strontium 87 to 86
in three crystals, like in the last slide I showed you of a rock, would have the same isotopic composition at some initial state, and plot here at A prime, B prime, and C prime. And as time passes, each of these parts would then grow and lie again on the line, pointing back toward one of the clocks, which was the original broken clock. And the credibility of the data then is how well they would lie in such a line. This is not a schematic line. This is, in fact, one of the first lunar rocks that was dated. This is the isotopic ratio of strontium 87 to 86. And this is the parent nucleus, rubidium 87, which is still around today, and strontium 86. The data points are the centers, the dots in the centers of the circle. And as you can see, they seem to fit a straight line rather well. And so the age that comes out of that is 3.64 eons, 3,640 million years ago, plus or minus 50 million years, if you're generous with the errors. So the detailed chronologies that we talk about are based upon data which are as powerful as I've exhibited to you here, namely the self-consistency of the results is quite enormous. In all of these cases, we have a daughter product, strontium 87, and we have remaining behind the parent, rubidium 87. We will very soon get to where there's no parent left. Now, what is the conclusion of such data? The conclusion of such data is shown for the moon, and that here is now today. There was an ancient lunar magnetic field. That's what this cartoon compass is about. The basins that we see were all flooded with black lava, such as the bubbly black stuff I showed you between 3.1 and about 4.0 eons ago. There are pieces of rock, such as you saw in that breccia, which were formed back at 4.5, and an enormous gap in here. So in our sister planet, that's about what we can say about the time scale. And if we ask why there's a gap here, then we do indeed see some basic reason for expecting that. Namely, at 3.95 eons ago, the Great Big Imbrium crater, which you can see on a clear night with your naked eye, which is full with a black puddle of lava, was in fact excavated by an extremely large meteorite bombardment, which was in fact the terminal massive bombardment in the solar system. This means then, if we want to get back to that time scale that I associated with Mr. Nostradamus, the case of the Earth truncates here at about 3.8, with lots of violent activity in the Earth, nothing getting older. In the case of the moon, we have some objects which are left over from the beginning, and in fact, we also can show that that beginning of the moon was about 50 million years after the meteorites formed, and there was a flooding of Mare in this time after the last bombardment and absolute quiescence. That's certainly much better than here, but it means that we can't get back to the narrow line. It's therefore evident that the main principle of focus must be the meteorites, which come for the most part from sources unknown, many of which were known to form at 4.555 eons ago, and there are no fake numbers there. And it is these things, there are some younger ones produced by collisions, but it is these things which must be the love objects, which are made by processes not generally known, which will bring us back to the very earliest stages, and the issue now is quite how early and what evidence. Now, the memory that we wish to get to is from the current state of the solar system, which has been left in a kind of an isolation ward for 4.555 eons from the injection of freshly synthesized nuclear matter from other stars and from stardust. It's been left pretty much, except for galactic cosmic rays, in an isolation ward for 15 eons approximately before then, 10 to 15, we don't know for sure. Stars have been born, died, made, and remade. Dust has been processed again and again through the interstellar medium. And these gas, stars, gas, and dust have been mixed back up together again through the cosmic blender and were dumped 4.55 so-and-so eons ago through the isolation ward to make this debris heap on which we rest. The memory which we ask for now is not simply the memory that has persisted over the past 3 or 4 eons, as we may see for both the Earth and our sister planet, the Moon, but wish to penetrate all the way back to the precursors of this and that which constitutes a connection with the processes that make nuclear matter in stars. And that's a hope that has been shared and pursued for 3 decades by the whole scientific community with not a hell of a lot of luck. So it is that memory now that we tried to press on to, and the background is that in the places where we have large amounts of carefully selected material, we have great difficulty. Now, it's a detective story, as you will shortly see. About the time Apollo 11 was flying, just to keep everybody busy, an incredible thing happened. 2 tons of rock fell out of the sky from an unknown source in a place called a little town called Pueblito de Allende, in a nearby big city of Parral, and the El Correo de Parral. Everybody ran out on the roof because people thought it was the end of the world. The sky was lit up so you could see it from about 800 miles away from aircraft, and a chunk of rock fell out of the sky, busted up, and it was in fact a rare phenomenon which has caused a revolution in our part of the science. And here's one of the chunk bolides that exploded in the air, which we took in the strewn field, which is the most impressive thing to see. And the story is sort of told. That thing weighs about 30 kilos, and it's got a funny bunch of white little specks in it. The edges are broken off, and that's the Allende meteorite. And that's what it looked like. It was pulled out of the ground. You can still see the dry grass marks on it. And that's Pandora's box. Well, you know, I'm sure all of you know the story of Pandora's box. Pandora's box was left open by unfortunate Pandora, in which all the evils of mankind were cut loose. And she, fortunately, it was a jar, actually, if you read the original Greek, which my Greek colleague told me, fortunately clapped it up while hope was still left inside. Otherwise, mankind would have destroyed itself. And here is hope, somewhat out of focus, but that's sort of the way hope is. And here's what it looked like busted open. And remember the chunk, the aggregate of busted up rock from the Moon that was glued together? It's kind of a similar story. This certainly didn't come from the Moon. And here are a whole bunch of funny different objects in it, including this one, which as you see over a centimeter across. It's a white, funny looking thing. And in these objects, what is found? I wonder if I can communicate verbally with a projectionist.
By the telephone,
yes. Do I have to dial? Hello? Would you please look at the right screen that the audience is seeing? I think it's slightly out of focus. That's very kind. Thank you. He was in a bar. It will take him a few minutes to get here. So if you look at the box, and I have these slides dated. The reason they're dated is because about every 6 months or a year, there's another nutty thing found in there. All of us learn in school that the law of constant combining weights and the constancy of the atomic weights. And I will tell you 2 things tonight. There are nuclei present in this material when it formed, which are all extinct. And secondly, that almost every element which is looked at has a different atomic weight from what you read in the handbook. That's all. So far, all that's been done is oxygen, calcium, strontium, samarium, aluminum, neodymium, titanium, silicon, calcium, barium, palladium, and magnesium. But I'm sure that as time progresses and our skills increase, the problems that come out of here will even be messier. Now,
you all need guidance, because I tell you it's going to be a mystery story, and it's not clear whether the arrows that I will, the streets I will take you with, will be one-way streets or not. But I wish to tell you that there are many hints and many directions to all of us that are coming out of that Pandora's box of material, and some of which have led us into blind alleys and others have given us insight. It certainly has not given us full understanding or wisdom. Now, that white blob you saw surrounded by junk, this is a close-up of it, and this is the background material, and this is a coherent spherical object full of pink things, which is calcium aluminate, calcium magnesium titanium silicate, and calcium magnesium aluminum silicate. And they're a rather uncommon, if not to say extraordinary, minerals in meteorites on the Earth. Some of them are extremely rare. And a young Canadian by the name of Larry Grossman did a rather silly thing. He calculated the following thing. Suppose you had a bag of sun and you cooled it. What would the things be that crystallized out from a bag of sun? Well, there's aluminum oxide. There's a calcium titanate, there's calcium aluminum magnesium silicate, that's the white stuff. There's magnesium aluminate, that's the pink stuff. And there's something sort of like calcium magnesium silicate, which is the black stuff. So the first hint, such as the little Swedish child had, and the other thing is that the white blobs in this crazy object have approximately the composition that would come out of a ball of hot gas of the composition of the sun. And that is a hint. You can't forgo that. Now, let's try to look now at some other hints which are nuclear and are a little harder to tinker with, because you possibly may make all of those things in a different form of chemistry. The time scales I spoke to you about for the planets are based upon radioactive parents, all of which are still alive today, and their daughter products. Each of these has a mean lifetime, which is very long compared to the age of the Earth, or comparable to it, the Earth being 4.5 in these units. So the rubidium-87 and the strontium-87 we talked about before has a mean lifetime of 72 eons, which is like even longer. That's much older than the age of the universe. So all of these objects have both parent and daughter. So that if I find, for example, lots of argon in something with lots of potassium, and they both have the same mass number, I have good reason to suppose that the daughter is the product of the parent. We're now going to go into a world where all of the parents do not exist. What we see are daughters, and we must infer whether or not the parent is there. Now, that may seem like a difficult exercise, and I can assure you that having spent many years doing it, it is difficult. The most important thing is it has to be done correctly, because once we make that statement stick, you must believe the chronology which I showed you alongside of Mr. Nostradamus. The current status is as follows. The radioactive nuclides like plutonium-244, which must be produced in extremely high density stars with lots of neutrons, like the number of neutrons per cubic centimeter must be sort of like the number of atoms per cubic centimeter in the glass of water. The daughter products are fission products. The lifetime, mean lifetime, is 120 million years. There's iodine-129, which is totally extinct. Its daughter product is xenon-129, with a time scale of 23 million years. Palladium-107, its daughter is silver-107, 9.4 million years. Aluminum-26 with a daughter, magnesium-26 with 1 million years, and maybe calcium-41, whose daughter is potassium-41 with a 140,000-year half-life. All of these are absent. The game must be to demonstrate the presence of a daughter in a chemical compound which is preserved in one of these debris heap objects. But the crystals in which these are present should be the crystals which in fact contain, the element aluminum and not magnesium. And so that's what the game is, and that's what I will try to demonstrate for you. And the contrast between what is on your right for the parent being present and here where these no nuclei are all man-made,
is what we must do next. Now, there are going to be two problems. One is that there will be extinct nuclides in which the parent element is there. What we see is the decay product and must infer from that the existence of the parent at the time the object was made. And the next issue is, if you're going to be around the nuclear factory, you might find a whole bunch of general debris and must pay attention to that, which is very important. For those of you who have not ever tried to separate isotopes, I will remind you of a rule. Any kindergarten kid can boil water away from salt. You can separate the chemical elements very easily. To separate the isotopes of an element and produce a pure isotope usually takes most of modern technology. So there's plenty of chemical separation in the solar system. There is very little isotopic separation, and it's this which we use as an assumption in the rest of the calculations. Now then, the question is, what is the key to the problem? Well, the key to the problem for 15 years was the discovery of iodine-129, which I will kind of relive for you, and that was the key. And it was not discovered by me because I looked in the wrong place, but my friend John Reynolds at Berkeley discovered it and was careful enough to give me a room at the Hotel Durant at Berkeley and put me in the room with this number. But I wish to point out to you that the key does not go in the lock, and that will be the rest of the discussion. For 15 years, we have all believed, since the demonstration of iodine-129, which I will get to shortly, that the last time junk was dumped out of stars into the medium which was then went to make up the Earth was a time scale, as indicated here, of 160 million years. The data which I will show you now will show you that's not true. And in fact, the time scale is less than 3 million years, maybe only 200,000 to 500,000 years. So that's collapsed the time scale of which connects the debris heap on which we ride, our planet and our solar system, with stellar activity on a time scale that is almost instantaneous. So the 129 abundance was used to establish the scale. Its existence is unequivocal. And now I'll show you one of the experiments done for its existence. But in the rest of the talk will not be quite as rocky as it's been so far, and will really be the story of my life, which is wandering through the chart of the nuclides looking for isotopes in some fashion or another. And so I ask you to bear with me in walking up the proton-neutron number in order to get some feeling for what we do. This is the chart. This is the number of neutrons, number of protons. Here's iodine-127, which if for those of you who eat iodized salt, which I hope you all do, is what you buy. You don't buy this unless you buy it from either the United States Atomic Energy Commission, from Chalk River in Canada, or from any other nuclear nation in the world. That does not exist in nature. And if you just shoot neutrons in through normal elements, iodine, xenon, cesium, barium, what you would produce is a flow like this, and you would even have a hard time making iodine-129 unless you put enough neutrons in to knock this over two nicks. We will explore the rest of the chart of the nuclides in the rest of the talk, of course, but for simplicity, let's just look at the neighborhood here of iodine-129, which decays to make xenon-129. Now, there isn't any iodine-129 left today. And so just to confirm what Randall showed, let's just look at the following simple thing. We go inside of that black debris heap and look at one of the white balls. And one of the white balls, if you look very carefully with a microscope, this is a 10 micron scale, you find it has little crystals marked S in it. And they're all intergrown very nicely. And S is a sodium, aluminum, iodine silicate. So it's a iodine crystal. And if it's a very ancient iodine crystal, it certainly shouldn't have rare gases in it. It should have pure iodine-129 decay product, which is pure xenon-129. And this is the logarithm of the number of atoms observed versus the mass number 128, 129, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 30. And in fact, it's better than ivory soap. It's 99.9% pure iodine-129 decay product. So there's no question that these objects contain the daughter products of extinct nuclides intimately associated with the exactly correct chemical phases. But that doesn't solve our 160 million year timescale problem. And now let's drop off to a somewhat shorter timescale, like the aluminum-26 problem. This is sodium, magnesium, aluminum, and silicon. This is neutron number and proton number. If you had aluminum-26 present, it only lives for half-life of 700,000 years. It decays to make magnesium-26. This does not alter the abundance of magnesium, which has isotopes 24 and 25. It only adds to 26. So now, just as in the case of the iodine-129, xenon-129, I now must exhibit for you as testimony for the legitimacy of the claim made adjacent to the Nostradamus watercolor. No, it wasn't a watercolor, it was a colored engraving. I must demonstrate to you that crystals which are aluminum crystals, which basically have almost no magnesium in them, have vast excesses of magnesium, 26, and unaffected by of the other magnesium isotopes. Now then, some of the experiments are trivial. These are crystals, that's about 100 microns across, and that's about 100 microns across, and that's about 40 microns thick. And some of the data which I will show you, not to flim-flam you with technical details, were in fact done on these objects which you see, each of which is only about 100 microns or smaller in size. Now, then once, in fact, you got the idea to look, you even looked at some other strange black objects like this meteorite Murchison, and this is an extremely large object. It's 800 microns across, that's 8-tenths of a millimeter, and the problem was to peel this radially because this is, in fact, the highest temperature, the earliest condensate of a major chemical compound that would come out of a piece of hot sun. And in fact, this is not Excalibur. This is the tip of a micro device. This distance is 30 microns, and we're peeling off the layers, and the blue stuff is in fact an aluminum mine, which should contain pure magnesium-26. So these are symbols of the experiments which my colleagues and I have done, and the results are shown here. This is the ratio of magnesium-25 to magnesium-24. Here's magnesium-26 to magnesium-24, and the numbers are the deviations in percent from what you would have if you handled a normal piece of chalk dust, which, and I can assure you, does not exist in my laboratory. When we did that, we had some problems. So here's where chalk dust would plot in here, and the white walls sometimes are very funny and fall along this funny line up here, which are highly correlated and which we don't understand. But all of the aluminum-rich phases plot straight out this way, as if the 25-24 ratio has not changed, and as if you are adding Mg26 to aluminum-rich crystals. Now, there are, of course, isochrons to be expected, just as I indicated to you before, and this is a cartoon of what you would expect for phases with different ratios of aluminum, normal Reynolds wrap aluminum to magnesium-24, and the isotopic composition magnesium-26 to magnesium-24. And this is what is in fact observed. And two of these data points are the two crystals which you saw on the slide shown to you before in polarized light. So this shows the correlation of the magnesium-26 excesses with the increase in the aluminum-magnesium ratio, which is not bad for non-government work. Now, that seems like a hell of a lot of work. It took a long time to do it. It's very difficult, and it doesn't look very important. And so I'll try to tell you what it means. The slope of that line is 5 × 10⁻⁵. And that is the ratio of the number of aluminum-26 atoms to the number of aluminum-27 atoms present at the time one of these raindrops fell. That is the data which constitutes the evidence that the time scale between last stellar injection and the formation of the solar system was less than 1 million years. How much is roughly 1 part in 10,000 of all aluminum being aluminum 26? Well, the situation in the interstellar medium, this gas and dust cloud, which must have been the precursor of the Earth, is such that the aluminum 26, which we've indicated here, is sufficient to convert that into a beautiful plasma because it is extremely radioactive. All solid bodies whose radius is less than about 1 kilometer, formed of normal garden variety material, with that abundance of aluminum 26, would melt in 100,000 years. And it's far more intense than if all the uranium and thorium on the Earth were to decay almost instantaneously. So it's a hell of a heat source. So this then quite clearly admits the almost immediate melting of all planets formed early. But the objects in which we find these are sort of like hailstones and raindrops, and are quite small. Now, we have another pronouncement to make. The pronouncement is, what about planets? Well, this is from the Cape York meteorite. This is iron sulfide, and this is iron nickel metal. The size of this object is a little bit bigger than the Volkswagen, just one of them, and is not a raindrop. It is not a hailstone. It is the melting inside of a planet which segregated metallic iron and iron sulfide from silicate. And this segregation of these materials also, of course, chemically fractionated the elements. Now there's a question. Is there some nuclide which would be present at the time that such planets were made and segregated, which would preserve a nuclear signature to fit us into the time schedule? The answer is yes, indeed there is. And that is palladium-107, which is a 6.5 million year half-life, and palladium has a large number of isotopes. Silver has 2. Their abundance, they are silver-107 and silver-109. The concentration of these silver atoms in that piece of iron is 1 atom in 10 to the 11th. So you have to be somewhat clean about your work, and that means that if we look in the metal part of the meteorite, which if palladium-107 were alive at that time, we should see excess silver-107 compared to 109. And if we look in the sulfide, which has no palladium and lots of silver, we should find regular garden variety bolotai silver. This is what, and in fact, we measured. So this difference from here to here corresponds to a shortfall of 109, or an excess of silver-107, correlated with the presence of palladium, and therefore means that a 6 million year old radionuclide was present at the time a planet melted. Well, that's sort of all we have, and so the summary then is as follows. Plutonium-244 has been known since 1969 to have been present in the early solar system. It is produced in a high neutron density circumstance. Iodine-129, all of these now are inferred from the daughter products because none of these are found. Xenon-129, I've shown you, a clear example inferring the presence of iodine-129 in small dust balls. Silver-107 was present as produced by palladium-107 in planetary matter which had been melted, and aluminum-26, which produced, of course, magnesium-26, was present in small balls of material about 1 centimeter in size, and it is from that we get this evolutionary time scale. Namely, there was an event of late nucleosynthesis, which in substantially less than 3 million years had to produce dust, rain, and hail from stellar debris, and that this is represented by the small white objects. Within 10 million years, as inferred from the palladium-silver data, small planets were formed and melted. And from the measurements that we know of the age of the moon and the Earth, and from what one knows also about Newtonian dynamics, there is perfectly good reason to believe that this was about 100 million years later. Now, the time scale seems fixed, and there are a couple of other things. So we have late additional material of stuff from stellar debris dumped in to make the stuff in the solar system. And if we look at a kind of a mass spectrum of stuff made up in different places in stars or different stars, these are the mass numbers of the isotopes at different layers in a star or maybe in the solar system, that depending upon how these proportions are mixed, the constant combining weights which we thought we would see might be variable. In this matter, which is the rest of Pandora's box, there are STP or SRP, slow neutron, rapid neutron, and proton and gamma ray bombardment of the material which got poured into the stuff that made the solar nebula. The gentleman over here I've shown you is Robert N. Clayton, University of Chicago, who for some reason has never foregone his Canadian citizenship in spite of his long residence there, and is in fact responsible for the extremely important discovery of the oxygen isotopic anomalies present in all of the material which I just showed you. So oxygen is bizarre, and now I want to tell you what bizarre means in a kind of way. If I were to make a graph of normal, the abundance of isotopes that you find around prior to people making bombs or nuclear devices, they would all have an abundance pattern which was flat. If you had added material to it or were to add material to it, you would find excesses at peculiar places or deficits. And I simply wish to exhibit these to you. There are the same samples which I showed you pictured. These are the isotopes of samarium and their abundance pattern showing vast aberrances. The normals would be here at zero. Another object is perfectly normal except for an excess at mass 144. For barium, which is near iodine, I remind you, so it's not so far away, there are excesses at masses 135 and 137, where there are shortfalls in masses 135 and 137. It's worse than I showed you because this simply looks as if there are excesses and simple shortfalls. If I show you some more recent data, partially near the iron group of nuclei, which is the case of titanium, a very abundant, not a rare element. This is 49 titanium, 48 titanium, 47, 48 titanium. And here is normal titanium is this little white dot. And from this debris that's fallen in from the meteorites and from several meteorites, one can see points which plot here, scatter here, and here, and those are the errors. It is perfectly clear that this guarantees at least a 3, if not 4 or 5 dimensionality of mixtures. Namely, we are looking at inhomogenized material which must have a nuclear and stellar origin. Now, what does one say to such an incredibly bizarre array of what we learn from grammar school to high school through university must be the case? Well, we don't know. And I get many papers from my theoretical colleagues and many claims by many people. And the most important thing to say is it's exciting. I sat once in my rooms with the most distinguished theoretician and very close friend, Dick Feynman, and I said, I'm very upset. He said, why are you upset? I said, I don't understand. He said, if you're doing something important and you don't understand, that's the best time of your life. And I think that's a fair statement. Now, I review for you that we are looking at old dust that's not fully mixed, or we're looking at old dust and new dust that's not fully mixed. We don't know which. We know that there's the addition of short-lived radionuclides which are either made from a modest precursor like a 20 solar mass star that has exploded about a half a million years before the solar system formed to help seed us, or else our sun went rather berserk in an extremely high energy phase. The time scale and time schedule, which we may now construct with incredible accuracy, that this isn't a mistake now. If everything I said before was correct, here is what the rate of making nuclei was like on a log scale versus time. within less than a million years, at least 1/10,000th of a solar mass of material was injected into our immediate neighborhood. The last time before then that anybody got nasty and dumped in fresh stellar matter had to be about 100 to 200 million years before then. And in fact, that did happen because plutonium-244 is present. And we know something about the astrophysical sites and the timescales. And there is no curium-247. Therefore, the bumps which I listed here, here, and here are in fact quite correct for the major addition of uranium and the transuranic elements, in fact, had to happen on the old time scale. And what we are looking at here is a small but very real bump of late-stage nucleosynthesis which got added to the matter. Now, we should return this to the astrophysical scenario which must really have started us off. There are interesting places. I guess this is a W3 region, and I guess Cassiopeia. And here's a great big glowing mass of material, and here's a box drawn around something that's not particularly important. There's nothing there that you can see in the visible. If you draw a map of either radio emission in exactly the same region or infrared light emission, what you find is that this perfectly normal, unobtrusive spot is the source of emission of enormous radio waves and infrared radiation. The inference is perfectly clear. So there's something very hot inside here, which we don't see in the visible or the ultraviolet. It's about 100,000 times more luminous than the sun. It is surrounded by dust so that the visible radiation cannot get out. And the only way that radiation is getting out is by heating the dust grain so that it may radiate in the infrared. These are, in fact, the stellar birthplaces, the places where supernova are blowing off in dense molecular clouds, where the density is maybe a million times more dense than the normal interstellar medium. And the time scales for the collapse of such regions are precisely the time scales you would calculate from the lifetimes of the nuclides, which I've just enunciated for you. It's not clear that we understand, but it's certainly clear that between the isotopic and cosmochemical and geophysical studies which I enunciated and the very exciting astrophysical studies going on by direct observation, that there is some chance of some future understanding. I thank you.
Speaker will receive questions, so if you'll raise your hand, I'll indicate who is to ask a question and ask the speaker to repeat the question before answering. Lady on the left. Could you repeat that?
The one on the earth. Well, right now they're getting sort of common. The most ancient rocks are found in West Greenland, in the Godthåbfjord area. They're also found in Africa. They're also found in the Canadian Shield. They're now also found in the Minnesota River Valley, and they're found in Australia. And they are all about the same age, and the number is about 3.4 to 3.8. And so while they were rare, after 23 years or 30 years of looking, they're getting more common. And the techniques for finding them, of course, have improved.
Further questions?
I was told it's a pretty wild audience, and I actually have my bulletproof vest on.
That was in Mexico.
Gentleman back there.
Do you think you would recognize an interstellar brain if you met
one or not? Oh, yeah, we fight about that all. Oh, the question is, would we know one if we saw one, namely an interstellar grain? Yes. Unequivocally, yes. And I think the answer really is sort of like, and we spend a lot of time looking for them, but they're very small. If we use the following argument, that each part of a star and each different stellar evolutionary site must have exceedingly different circumstances, temperature and pressure-wise, for nucleosynthesis. So it's very difficult to imagine that the nuclear signatures would be the same everywhere. And it is therefore that which is used as the guidance. The typical sizes that we expect is about a tenth of a micron, which is not too big. And right now we're drilling holes through some objects looking for them. We go an angstrom a second and hope to find some. So far, the evidence is that whatever interstellar grains must have been present in the solar nebula are now blended out and homogenized on, say, a centimeter scale for objects or a millimeter scale. But that's a major issue, and once a year somebody makes an announcement and then they get shot full of bullet holes. And the advantage is that if you have one and you destroyed it by testing for it, nobody can check you. There are lots of ideas. The problem is the truth. The most clear source of meteorites must come from the asteroidal belt. There is no doubt, however, that the zodiacal dust cloud, which you see looking away from the sun, of small particles of interplanetary dust grains, are dominated by maybe at least 50% to 90% by the disaggregation of comets. Now, one of the questions is whether cometary material is sometimes captured and resident in the asteroidal belt and later become Apollo objects, which they fall on the Earth. But that, I think, is a general status of things, and all of these are under very immediate scrutiny. That is, right now, a great deal of thought and work is being given to collecting samples of comet dust tails. When the Earth passes through a comet dust tail, you may fly U-2 aircraft up and collect a few hundred 10 micron particles, and they're big. But the dominant source of the meteorites is thought to be the asteroidal belt, and the question is what has populated it.
That solid mass of iron nickel that is created that huge crater down in California. You know what I'm talking about. It's about a mile across and
A meteor crater.
Yeah, meteor crater.
Yes.
Yeah. Would you say that was the material from a star, or did this thing coagulate with the heat on the way down?
The question was a meteor crater, Barringer crater, and that's the product of a meteorite impact. Almost all of these large iron nickel bodies are made by melting in a pre-existing planetary body that must have been, say, 50 kilometers across, which got heated, presumably by aluminum 26, made puddles of iron nickel under very reducing environments. These are, of course, pretty tough, and they're pretty hard to break up, so the rest of the planet, by the other collisions which we see clear evidence for on the moon and elsewhere, have disaggregated what's left of the silicate or softer portion of it, and you have chunks of iron nickel sitting around for a few eons, and that just fell into the atmosphere and punched the hole. But it did not aggregate on the way down. In fact, the problem, as you saw in the case of Allende, is disaggregation, because when the bolide comes in, if it's coming in at, say 15 kilometers a second, the problem is to keep it in one piece. The 2 tons that came in was scattered over something like 500 square kilometers. Mostly it's very small pieces. and my wife can testify to the number of thorns which she pulled out of various parts of my anatomy trying to find some of the pieces we recovered. It wouldn't. Oh, I'm sorry. I should. The question was, how could a large impact on, say, the moon or the Earth cause a prolonged period of volcanic activity? And it's a very good question. Indeed, the answer is it could not. Namely, the period of volcanic activity that, let's see, let me give you some numbers. Imbrium was hit at about 3.9. It was still flowing lava out 400 million years later. It cannot, therefore, be the result of the impact itself. It must be due to the heat sources inside of the moon, the decay of uranium and thorium inside of the moon, and a still hot moon from accretion, which continued to effuse lavas for several hundred million years. So I think that may have triggered an initial volcanism, but the later flooding was due to internal heat sources.
So it would have happened anyway.
What has?
It would have happened anyway.
Without the meteorite. Oh, well, sure. No question about it. Yeah. But what happens is that when you had a big hole and you were going to flow out lava, you flooded the hole, and that's all we see. There's a lady back. The question was, if I can read so well backward in time, can I read the future as well? Well, there are the pronouncements one can make about death and taxes. But I don't think that I can say anything about the future. I could be very serious and say that the general status, the Pacific status of mankind does trouble me, and that future is rather evident if one is not very careful. But more specific details I would relegate to answers in the death and taxes of individuals.
This will be the last question.
Was in space, was there always something in space?
Was there always something in space? Well, that's like a Zen applause. It's just one hand applauding by itself. I hope not to hear that. That's a profound and it's a philosophical question. And I don't think this is the forum to discuss. It has certainly received an enormous amount of attention. And if one refers to the general ideas of even the most modern versions of the theory of relativity, space without anything in it is not part of our universe.
Dr. Yvonne Russell of the Department of Geophysics and Astronomy will thank our speaker.
Does he get hung with this too?
Probably doesn't need to.
When Jerry Wasserberg was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, he was carrying out his thesis studies at a time when this fascinating and important subject was just beginning. So that one can say that his career has paralleled the career of all of these studies. But one can say a lot more than this. One can say that Jerry Wasserberg's personal research has set a standard against which all of this field and all of those working in this field have had to measure up. There's no way I can say enough what his contributions have been. The Vancouver Institute likes to end its season with a winner. I think we've done this tonight. It's my very pleasant task, Jerry, to thank you on behalf of the audience present and on behalf of the Vancouver Institute. Thank you.